as you may well know, the shadow of a human figure is a constant trope as well through Bacon's works, and often we see a shadow where it, rather than the presence of a figure. But Bacon also distinguished between the violence of paint, what he called the violence of paint, and the violence he had lived through. And this is an interesting quote on the slide there. "This violence of my life, the violence which I've lived through, I think it's different to the violence in painting. When talking about the violence of paint, it's nothing to do with the violence of war. It's to do with an attempt to remake the violence of reality itself." This question of remaking the violence of reality rather than representing the experience of violence is key to how Bacon sees the task and the act of painting. And the violence of reality is not only the simple violence, he says, meant when you say that a rose or something is violent, but it's the violence also of the suggestions within the image itself, which can only be conveyed through paint. So the making of the painted image itself creates violence, which is a really curious, it's rather curious to see there how he talks about a rose being violent. But if we look at this painting, we might intimate what he's getting at. This painting titled Figure Study One, which is quite curious considering we can't see the figure, so we're not sure what is being referred to, obviously includes a lot of flowers, and flowers are a part of a strange assemblage without a clear identity, an assemblage that is both concealed and revealing itself at the same time. And that obscurity lends a pretty disturbing quality. So it's not that flowers are inherently violent, but it's the way that they're painted, the suggestions, as Bacon says, expressed by the image itself in the process of its making, that underscores their violence. As he says, painting must unlock the valves of feeling and therefore return the onlooker to life more violently. This is the trio of paintings that face us as soon as we enter the first main room of the exhibition at the Academy. And what we see here are elements of everyday life: flowers, a hat, a coat, umbrella, a patch of grass. We see those elements transformed and made into platforms, even ciphers, for the unlocking of feeling. There's a curious, quite jarring superimposition of the ordinary, the umbrella, the flowers, with extremity, like the open jaws of this peculiar biomorph beast on the right. And that juxtaposition returns us to life more violently. So this is not life as we normally see it. Of course, it's not everyday life that we perceive and could imitate if we were an illustrational painter. It's a life that is retold to us all the more intensely. Violence is never far from the surface of Marcel Hanselaar's paintings either. The violence underlying and accompanying human experience that is often repressed in civil society is an ongoing concern and interest of her work, and has been for many decades. This group of prints comes from a more extensive collection called The Crying Game, which was a response to the war prints of Otto Dix, and express collectively different kinds of violence, different kinds of violence that humans inflict on each other, from war to acid attacks, to addiction, to torture. The spectrum of human violence and the human, in Marcel's words, intolerance of difference. Imagery here explores what is prohibited to show or speak of in everyday life. And I think that notion of what an image can do and the difference between images and illustration brings us back to Bacon, who also makes that distinction very strongly between painting and illustration. again, with reference to Picasso's work here, this work, which is a small panel painting of a bather at the beach unlocking a cabin door. Bacon says this work is more real than if it had been an illustration of a figure unlocking the door of a bathing cabin. Now, it might seem quite strange to call something more real that is actually rather abstract. What's Bacon getting at? Well, what he's getting at here is a sense of reality that is more intense than the ordinary. It's more real because sensation is purified and stripped of all the tropes and motifs that make something a storytelling device. So if you think about illustration, and this is what Bacon was trying to get at, illustration tells us something in a, well, his words were, a diatribe through the brain. So it kind of gives us something that we then have to go away and interpret a story. We have to see what the story is telling us and form a conclusion about it or something like that. Whereas painting, he says, acts directly on the nervous system. Painting is, in Deleuze's words, a logic of sensation that acts directly on the nervous system. It doesn't have to be interpreted as an illustration does. And that's what he means by saying that a work like this is more real than if it had been an illustration. It's directly felt rather than having to be intellectualized. This is one of the resonances between Bacon and Marcel Hanselaar that struck me straight away when I first saw her works. I was really struck by the rejection of storytelling, which was quite, it was strange because there's lots of figures in her works. You could extract stories from them, certainly, but there's an investment of figuration for something more direct, something that affects us because of its nervous quality, its nervous energy. What we could say, in Bacon's words, is an intensified reality, intensified precisely because it doesn't pass through the mediation of a story. In conversation with Marcel, she's been keen to stress that her works are never based on pre-existing stories, and that there's no translation of pre-existing stories, that the works grow organically through the act of painting itself, and therefore that she doesn't often know what images she'll paint until they emerge from that act, and sometimes they shock even herself. And this is something that connects her and Bacon, that neither use sketches or rehearse their paintings in a space outside the canvas. The canvas itself is the site of the work, or that engagement with a problem, with a sensation, if you like. This is a key factor in the distance between Marcel's work and the work of another very prominent figurative painter today, Paul Arago, who had a major show, a retrospective at the Tate at the end of last year. Paul Arago often bases her works on pre-existing stories, fairy tales, nursery rhymes, and such like. But Marcel doesn't, and neither does Bacon. In fact, Bacon was very clear that he wanted to, what he called, sort of isolate the image and take it away from stories from the interior and the home as well. That was one reason why Bacon, in fact, felt uncomfortable about putting multiple figures in one scene. He said, when you start to sort of put a lot of figures together in a group, that's when a story emerges, because the relations between them start to conjure a story, a narrative relationship, and that starts to talk louder than the paint. So this is interesting to think about, and I was thinking about this in relation to Marcel's work, because the crowd is a constant feature, often a constant feature in many of the works. Many of her works interrogate group dynamics, and those quite disturbing dynamics between the individual and the group identity. And in this series here on the slide, we see that relation between the individual and the crowd played out in different ways in scenes that convey, like Bacon's, a sense of menace without a clear source or maybe even a clear ending or direction. I think what's interesting about the nature of groups here in this series of works is their disconnect from each other. So you might notice how the characters come from different times or could be seen to refer to different times and places. And they're not always united by a single function, such as a procession, as they might be, as implied by the title. There's also an indifference sometimes to the function in front of them, such as the event of mourning. And those sort of affects of indifference, of uncertainty, express something of the bestial nature of a crowd, I think. And that takes us to the question of the relation between man and animal in both artists' works. The violence that runs through both Bacon and Marcel's work is intensely bound up with that relation of human and animal. And this is a central theme of the Royal Academy show. The third major room of this show focuses on Bacon's obsession with animals. During the 1950s, he painted many works of dogs featuring chimpanzees. In that decade, he made many trips to South Africa, and the works reflect memories and images of wild animals seen in non-grass. When he came back, he made multiple visits to London Zoo and studied caged animals, which accounts perhaps for some of those strange cages and geometric frames that we see. And he also collected quite obsessively images of animals from books and magazines. Bacon approaches the human condition through the animal and the animal through the human. So animals are painted as portraits. And you can see that here in this painting on the left, called Study for a Chimpanzee, where we see the chimpanzee sitting and pondering as though in contemplation, which is perhaps not an attitude we might be accustomed to seeing or thinking about a chimpanzee in. So it's a portrait of the chimpanzee. In the other painting on the right there, head four, man with a monkey, a man in a suit gazes into the darkness, into the abyss, whilst the head of a monkey looks back out at a space, an indeterminate space. It's not him and it's not us. There's a very curious merging of man and animal here, and you can see this peculiar indistinct zone where their heads collide. Is a kind of black overlapping zone where it's neither man and neither animal, and you can't really tell what kind of being it is that's being captured or expressed. Bacon, as ever, was very eloquent about his insights, his thoughts about this relationship between man and animal. He said he wanted to paint. He wanted to use the texture of rhinoceros skin to help him think about the texture of human skin. So again, you know, it's an interesting way to think about how to depict the human, not directly, but through the animal. Why would you look at the texture of rhinoceros skin to help you approach something about the human condition? Later on, when he started his famous series of the Pope paintings, he said, he made a note in one of his books, to concentrate entirely on studies of the human figure, situate the figure in attitudes of apes. And again, you know, I don't think this is something that's well known about his paintings of the popes, actually, that he was exploring this proximity to the animal whilst he was making this series. And you see in this painting this very strange merging of chimpanzee and Pope. where the Pope is becoming ape-like and the ape is becoming, dare I say, Pope-like. It's actually on a seat. So it's a rather confusing and interesting conflation. Of Velázquez, who was a source for his very famous series of Pope paintings, paintings after Velázquez's portrait of Pope Innocent X, he said, "My aim is to paint like Velázquez, but with a texture of hippopotamus skin." And he was keen to emphasize he wasn't interested in Velázquez for the religious dimension of the works, but for the fact that they expressed something intense about a human, about the human condition, about an affect that could be isolated and then intensified through paint. And that's what you see in the famous series that he did, this intensification of affect, of sensation, taken away from any direct relation to the Christian framework, or the religious framework. I just want to say one thing here about the scream, because Bacon was very interested, as we've seen before, in the mouth. But the mouth is something almost disembodied from, dissociated from the human face, a kind of feature in itself, as we saw in that first head, number one. And we see that again in this painting of the Pope, where the scream itself, the screaming mouth, has a life in itself. It's taken away from the face. It's not really part of a facialized expression, and it's doing something else. What is it doing? Well, it's conveying the sensation of screaming, the horror of the scream. Bacon said, "I wanted to paint the scream more than the horror," but as he reflected, he thought, maybe that's the wrong way around. Maybe I should be trying to extract the horror, and the scream kind of is just the framework for a more primal state that painting should be capturing. And on that, you know, he referred to these two images as some kind of key sources for his thinking of the mouth, of the screaming mouth. On the left, Sergei Eisenstein, this is a still from his famous battleship Potemkin, he said was one of the most intense expressions of a screaming mouth and a model for his work. And on the right, Poussin, Massacre of the Innocents, which he said was the greatest depiction of a scream in the history of Western painting. Coming back then to the animal, and here is one last painting I'd like to share with you, where, you know, it was based on a painting, a rhinoceros in Africa being stalked. And Bacon has substituted, as if you like, the man for the rhinoceros. So again, this strange, not even identification, but indiscernibility of man and animal. The man crouching in the grass as though stalked, and you can see the shadowy figure of a stalker, a watcher, or someone behind him lurking in the shadows. This quote by Gilles Deleuze, I think, really well captures some of the things I'm trying to express here, which is that in place of formal correspondences between man and animal, what Bacon's painting constitutes is a zone of indiscernibility or undecidability between man and animal. So in place of any likenesses between man and animal, things that make them look like each other, like this man looks like a dog, Bacon's interrogating something deeper and more profound, which is the zones at which that boundary breaks down, the zones at which man becomes animal or discovers his animal condition, and the zones at which animal approaches man. Bacon himself thought that it was meat that expresses this common zone. He said, actually, what I'm interested in most is meat. Meat, like the butcher's meat. He said, we are all meat. We are all potential carcasses. If I go into a butcher's shop, and I'm quoting from him, I always think it's surprising that I wasn't there instead of the animal. So this, again, identification or indiscernibility in terms of the meatiness that constitutes our condition, our lived condition, but also the condition that takes us very close to death, because it's the meat that is hanging there in the butcher's shop and is actually all that remains. So coming back to Marcel Hanselaar's work and this extraordinary series, Under My Skin, which is a series of five works that show a girl woman at different stages of development in relation to and dynamics with a creature, a wolf-like dog. At the In and Out show, we've presented two of these works. Number three, which is at the top right, in which the woman faces the dog standing here, mouth agape, tongue drooping in this diaphanous sort of apron. And number five, which is the bottom right, in which you see the woman emerging almost from the flayed skin of that dog, or maybe it's another dog, and being observed by a very dwarfish man. So between these paintings, there's a very ambivalent relationship between woman, dog, and man, one that clearly has sexual undertones, and I explore that a bit more in my catalogue essay, if you're interested in reading a bit more about it. What interests me, in summary, is how the dog, woman, and man are less separate and distinct beings, although you could see them as separate and distinct, of course, but more and more interchangeable personages that stem, as Marcel Hanselaar has herself said, from the same source. So, you know, one of the ways in which this happens is this movement of the apron, the apron passing from dog to the room, the environment, back to dog to man. And that, you know, in the passage of that material garment, you feel a flow of being, as it were, between creature and man, human. A continuum, in fact, of man and animal. And Marcel herself has spoken about that in terms of the continuum of the primal and the civilized within the human condition. For Francis Bacon, the indiscernibility of man and animal is expressed through the face, or rather the deformation of the face, because Bacon deforms the face through techniques of rubbing and brushing the canvas and making a head emerge in its place. And that head often has those animal traits that we've seen in other paintings. And he writes, he states of that, you know, he says of the act of painting a head, he says, the other day I painted a head of somebody, and what the sockets of the eyes, the nose, and the mouth were, when you analyze them, were just forms which had nothing to do with eyes, nose, or mouth, but the paint moving from one contour into another made a likeness of this person I was trying to paint. What's really interesting here is that he's talking about the construction of likeness through the movement of paint, that portraiture is not something mimetic. It's not about capturing a likeness in front of you, but rediscovering it through this mobile generative process of working with the paint on canvas itself. He says that's what makes the image a kind of tightrope walk. He calls it a tightrope walk between figuration and abstraction. The image itself is always between figuration and abstraction. And he talked about of his paintings as images. And that's that tightrope walk, where the paint is always mobile and suggestive, is what brings the figurative right up to the nervous system even more violently. than seeing something mimetic, something realistic. As I've said, you know, Bacon was a great sort of, you know, student of the history of painting, and on portraiture, he was drawn to this late portrait by Rembrandt, late unfinished self-portrait. And he said what interested him about this particular portrait was that the eyes had hardly any sockets, that the head was completely anti-illustrational, that it was a head rather than a face that we were presented with. And this is something that Deleuze picks up on in his book, this idea of portraiture as something rather strangely not about faces. He says here, Bacon pursues a very peculiar project as a portrait painter, to dismantle the face, to rediscover the head, or make it emerge from beneath the face. And I think that's what you can see here, and see also in kind of the way in which Bacon's looking back to the history of painting, is that there's this kind of violence inflicted to the image, this extraction, this kind of rediscovery of the traits that might make something a head, but it's not about setting out to convey likenesses from the start. It's about finding them through that dismantling, quite a destructive process. So how do you dismantle a face? What's the technique? What's the working processes that you use? Well, Bacon had a very interesting working process, and as ever, he was extremely eloquent and clear about how he saw this. He said, the marks are made, they're involuntary marks, they're made on the canvas, and you then survey the thing like you would a sort of graph. And you see within this graph the possibilities of all types of fact being planted. For instance, if you think of a portrait, you maybe at one time have put the mouth somewhere, but you suddenly see through a graph that the mouth could go right across the face. So, you know, this is very, very interesting way of thinking about construction. You know, he's talking here about the construction of an image from traits. You could say the mouth is not any more, it's not any more given that a mouth sits somewhere in a face beneath the eyes and beneath the nose, for instance, and above a chin, but that you somehow find a mouth, and then the mouth suggests other bits of the face. So it's like a kind of organic growth of traits, and that creates a deformity. So it might be looking at this image that Bacon started with a mouth. It was the first thing he found through this diagram, this graph of marks accidentally, and that suggested a chin-like thing, suggested an ear, and then the ear came. And you know, for him, he spoke about this sort of diagrammatic method as a way of creating a second order of figuration, one that was discovered rather than given to you in advance. He has some very interesting remarks on the canvas as a sort of bed of cliches. He said that the white canvas terrifies me because it's saturated with cliches. It's all the sorts of things that you might as a painter paint, they're given to you in your memory, in your everyday experience. So the first thing to do is to enact this violence, to dismantle, to destroy the cliches and let something new emerge. Marcel Hanselaar also has a very interesting relation to the face, or defacement, I might say, in this series called The Oracle in Limbo, which is also on show at In and Out. We see the main oracular figure always covered. We never see their face. And we also see many of the other figures in the scenes either turning away from us or looking askance somehow, but never directly at us. And that kind of dynamic of sort of, you know, indirectness when it comes to facial expression creates an atmosphere of expression that it makes it quite difficult to name what it is that we're being shown. So there's a relation there, I think, between face and meaning, between face and interpretation. And I think Marcel Hanselaar very cleverly negotiates that line. She does it again in this series of works, which is in fact part of the same series called the North Sea series, which is her most recent extensive series, where we see it's a series of individual women figures at night, often in relation to the sea, near the seafront, by the sea edge. They're always turned away from us. So the face is always turned away from us. We're never shown the face of this figure. And they're all the more expressive, one might say, for that, for what is not shown to us, what's kept, what's not revealed. So that brings me to the end of my talk, actually, and I'm going to just summarize, maybe just briefly recap some of the areas I discussed to sort of open it to questions from you. One was this notion, first, this notion of figuration as deformation rather than representation or storytelling. The second was the notion of portraiture itself as capturing the head rather than expressing the face and going beyond likeness to what might be called the violence of sensation. The third was the relation between man and animal and how that plays out in the rethinking of what figuration can do, where that relationship is precisely one of indeterminacy and the continuum between those states. The fourth was about the process of making such work. And I think that relationship between creating, constructing images through violence, violent mark making, and the violence that eventually emerges and that we're left with, and that returns us to life more violently, inviting us to experience life more intensely and making perceptible what Bacon called the brutality of fact, in the world, which is the point at which painting expresses an ethics, I think. Thank you. I'll leave it there. Thank you very much.